Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about homeland security. And we have as our guest someone who has had a long career in government and public service and who spent some time as the Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security. His name is Admiral James Loy. He is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. His host here is the College of Law, and he'll be giving a talk on the role of government and the law this afternoon. I'll tell you more about that a little bit later on. It is open to anybody who would like to attend. In 2005, Admiral Loy retired as the Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security. He, in that capacity, was involved in all aspects of consolidating all of these various agencies into one cabinet department, as well as managing day-to-day activities of that agency. Before that, he served in the Department of Transportation as the Deputy Undersecretary for Security and Chief Operating Officer of the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA. Those are the airport screeners that now, if you fly, you're familiar with those folks. He retired from the U.S. Coast Guard in 2002. Having served in a number of capacities, he was the Commandant, the Chief of Staff. He was the commander of the Guard's Atlantic area and was a seagoing officer. He served tours aboard six cutters, including command of a patrol boat in combat during Vietnam and command of major cutters in both the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. And we're very pleased that he could be here with us to talk. Questions are welcome, as always. The one thing we ask callers is that they try to be brief. We can get in as many as possible, but anybody's welcome to call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
David, it's great to join you.
When you start thinking about homeland security, and you look at all the various things that are involved, all the things one might talk about, this is a very long list. So acknowledging that, that is a complicated topic. If I said, since 2001, since 9/11, if you look at all the things that we have done to try to make the United States more secure, to help us better cope with a terrorist attack, something like 9/11, pick out maybe two or three things, cases in which you would say, here, we really did a good job in dealing with this aspect. And I'm sure that, you know, there's no case where you couldn't do better. But if you say, well, you know, what were some of the things you'd say where I think here we've had some of our best success in addressing various aspects of the problem?
Surely. I'd probably pick aviation security as one of those and maybe randomly select the protection of critical infrastructure of our nation as another. These are ongoing problems. I don't suggest that those are two that we sort of have suitcased now and are behind us and we don't have to worry about those any longer. This is a constant worry stream as we go through time. But in the case of aviation security, I select that one mainly because that's what happened on 9/11, and we as a nation are sort of predisposed to look over our shoulder and be very, very good at what just happened, you know, as opposed to being a little bit more projective in terms of a balanced approach to things across the board looking into the future. So with respect to aviation security, having stood up the Transportation Security Administration and worked at DHS for those 4 years, the first order of business would be to say to the American people, we looked carefully to find the silver bullet. You know, what was that one thing out there that if we made that happen, it would make the difference and we can say to all the citizens and in our case reporting to the president that you don't have to worry about aviation security anymore. We got that suitcase. But we didn't find the silver bullet. And so our challenge was then to default to a layered system of security that we all find as citizens and as travelers at the airport and elsewhere today. So it is about hardened cockpit doors. It is about federal air marshals. It is about guns in the cockpit. It is about trained professionals at the checkpoints of airports as opposed to those things in the past. In the past, on 9/10/01, and even as we woke up on 9/11/01, security was a responsibility of the airlines, and I would offer it was a cost item on the budget sheet, and their salary scale, the training programs were attended to minimizing that cost in the in the airline's overall budget. Post 9/11, we have done remarkable things to collectively pull together this series of things that in the aggregate become a very, very solid security system, although none of them are 100% solutions. And so you default to this layered system of aggregating in series a number of 70, 80, 90% solutions, and you take advantage of the law of aggregate numbers and yield as a result a 95, 6, 7 kind of percentage of security. Challenge to me in aviation today remains twofold. I believe we've concentrated mightily on the people called passengers that get into the cabin of the aircraft. We probably still have a little bit of work to do on the cargo that goes into the belly of the aircraft. So this is, as I say, not a finished product, but it's one that we've done, I think, a remarkably good job on.
Yeah.
The second one on critical infrastructure protection, the president issued a directive. Those are called Homeland Security Presidential Directives, and one of them was about the 17 sectors then identified, like transportation, banking and finance, food, water, that comprise the critical infrastructure of our nation, and challenged the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security to be the coordinator of making certain all those sectors were properly secured, quote unquote. That is a work in progress. We have done remarkably good work in the chemical sector, remarkably good work in the banking sector, remarkably good work in a number of those sectors, including transportation. But as I say, none of this is one of those things where you wake up in the morning and you finish that one off and then don't have to worry about it any longer. It's ongoing work.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the subject of aviation security, not surprised because that was an area in which you worked. And you get at the very point that I think that now some people have been pointing to for a while, and that is, as you say, we're concentrating on passengers. And that we maybe we are doing what we could be doing with check bags, but cargo is still a real big issue. It seems to me that that is an area that people have been pointing to for years now and saying, yeah, good, we did the other things, but this is something we need to be doing too. I mean, what sort of progress are we making particularly towards making sure that all the cargo that goes into the plane is screened?
I think we're doing a dramatically better job than we ever have in the past. It's a handoff sequence, if you will, from the person who wants that cargo taken from point A to point B in the belly of that aircraft. There are handlers along the way. Each of the nodes in that system of handling have to be dealt with in terms of a security profile. And the ultimate goal, of course, is the 100% screening of the cargo that goes into the aircraft. Now, we even find ourselves in linguistic arguments. You know, what's the difference between screening and inspection with the notion of are we talking about physically opening and inspecting everything in that box or are we talking about putting it through an explosive detection machine such that the result is what we want it to be at the other end of the day? We press to minimize toward zero the potential for anything problematic to find its way into the belly of the aircraft. Not that different than what we do with passengers. Heretofore, we have concentrated on tactics. We recognize that when Richard Reed tries to light off his shoe in that transatlantic aircraft, then shoes all of a sudden are a consequential part of the security paradigm. And so until we have the new magnetometer that goes all the way to the floor instead of just to your anchor, we're stuck with taking our shoes off at the airport. The same with liquids. You know, when we uncovered the effort on the part of a number of transatlantic aircraft to potentially have explosive liquids aboard, that particular incident was snuffed by players overseas that we work with all the time. But then again, until the explosive detection capability at the checkpoint can identify liquids in the way that we would have them dealt with, then we're sort of stuck with our 3 ounces and our clear plastic bags. And so you grapple with tactics. At the same time, we want to be grappling with identifying the terrorist because those are all the tools of the terrorist trade, but ultimately it's the terrorist himself or herself that we would like to keep off that airplane. And so one of the keys, if you've ever flown on El Al, for example, the Israeli process is a very, very complete investigatory kind of interviewing technique process before you get on that airplane. Those players, those men and women are trained in behavior observation, so to speak, so as to help them identify the terrorist, as well as we try to detect explosive capability that might be going aboard. So that whole array of things comprise the security envelope of what Kip Holley, now the administrator at the Transportation Security Administration, is attempting to direct for our country.
Yeah. We have, again, as you say, we've been trying to get at people who go on the plane and the things that they take with them that we're capable of screening. I think that there also, though, is a significant problem here. And we have seen, that is, in internationally, we have seen terrorists wearing explosives, going aboard planes, blowing themselves up and taking down the plane. And that is something that we still don't really have the capacity to prevent if somebody, or perhaps we do. It was my understanding that we're still not doing that. I mean, that is, we have the technology to do it, but it would be expensive to implement that so that everyone went through something that sniffed them for explosives before they got on the plane. We could do it. It's just a matter of, you know, how are we going to pay for it? Is that not still a problem?
It's always going to be that balance. There's absolutely no doubt that there will always be the question of costs associated with the security paradigm that you would like to include. While I was at DHS, while I was at TSA, we forced upon ourselves the requirement to hold what I'd call a three-way conversation, because lots of people came to our doors with the next security idea, but we insisted that in order for them to come in and talk carefully about their new security idea, they had to help us understand what would be the economic implications of that new security idea, because we can do lots of things at a port, for example, that would bring to a halt the commerce that goes through that port. We'd have 100% or close security guarantees, but we would stifle commercial exchange of goods and services that we depend on in the global marketplace. The third element, so the conversations were about what would be the new enhancement in security. What were the economic implications? And the last one was the civil liberties implications. Mm-hmm. We wanted to understand carefully before we contemplated the idea of bringing forward a new policy idea, a new way of doing business, what would be the economic implications, what would be the civil liberties implications, and make certain that the package deal represented something that the American citizen in our constitutional system would support.
Just very quickly, and I have some callers. We'll get to them. I want to make sure they understand. I'm not going to make them wait forever. One other question that does indeed have to do with economics, some of the things that we've talked about and new technologies that we might implement, that's going to cost money. And it seemed that one of the points of argument was, well, who's going to pay for that? Mm-hmm. Is the taxpayer going to pay for it? Is the government going to pay for it? Are the airlines going to pay for it? Who is going to pay for it? And we're not talking about an inconsiderable amount of money.
No, we're talking about a lot of money. We knew, for example, in the window of 2001, 2002, when we were mandated by the Congress with the Aviation Transportation Security Act to stand up TSA and to initially outfit, if you will, the 450-plus airports around this country with this explosive detection capability, we recognized that we were placing into those airports probably vintage 98, 99 state-of-the-art technology. But at the same time, we were investing considerably in the science and technology, the R&D end of what might be the next generation of that capability that we could either retrofit, backfit, or replace the systems that literally that we were putting into place that day. And all of that R&D effort was keyed to the same kind of questions you were asking a moment ago about what is it that can't be detected by the current system that causes us to force more passengers to secondary screening and getting a more thorough look before we let them on the airplane, as opposed to the technical capability that might be there in the future, will be there in the future, that has magnetometers that go to the floor, that can detect the liquids just by walking through the mag. Then we will be able to relax and refocus, if you will, on customer service to a greater degree because the technical capability has displaced what heretofore has been a problem.
Yeah. Well, who do, though, we expect to pay for that? I mean, ultimately, do we expect – well, ultimately, we're going to pay whether the airlines are paying or whether the government is paying. But is that something that you're going to have to say to the airlines and perhaps to the people who operate airports saying, look –
you've got to pay your share.
You've got to pay your share.
I think
share.
It'll be a blended sharing. And I believe, frankly, David, that the general notion of what I'd loosely refer to as public-private partnerships are the answer, both to the identity of the fixes that can go forward in the future and the funding profile associated with those.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Admiral James Loy. He served as the Deputy Secretary for the Department of Homeland Security between 2003 and 2005, as Administrator with the Transportation Security Administration from 2002 until 2003. Also had before that a long career in the Coast Guard. He served as the Commandant of the Coast Guard from 1998 until 2002. He is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois as a guest of the College of Law. We'll be giving a talk on government and the law this afternoon at 3 o'clock. This is in the Max Rowe Auditorium at the law school, and I think anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. So we will first start out, I think, with a caller in Milford, Illinois. This would be line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Another interesting show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a couple of quick questions. I'll let your guest respond and I'll hang up. I was just wondering, you touched on it a little bit. I was just wondering, 15, 20 years out, let's just say, for a point of discussion, if we don't have any other 9/11 attacks per se, I was wondering if your guest could speak if he thought what air travel would look like. And what I'm getting at here is I've traveled a couple of times since 9/11 with our small family, and as anybody who has done so, they know that it was agony as far as taking off the shoes and all that other stuff. So I was just wondering if there was something in the works. You know, either eye pupil recognition or something that would streamline the process of getting on and off the airplane. And again, if no other attacks happened down the road, if he had an idea what air travel might look like. And then I was wondering, secondly, if he could speak to the law enforcement agencies worldwide, in other words, like Interpol. And has that level of communication between all enforcement parties gotten to the point where we have a pretty good idea of who we're looking for as far as terrorists or criminals, and is that information communicated? And I'll go ahead and listen off. Thanks.
All right.
Well, thank you very much for the two very good questions. Projecting air travel, in answer to the first question, out you indicated 15 or 20 years. I certainly believe that we will probably have had a couple cycles of technological improvement to the capabilities at the checkpoints. Your concerns with your family was to I can just see you shepherding your three children in the jump seats and the strollers and the laptops and being asked to take your shoes off and take your jacket off, et cetera, all at the same time. As I said earlier, where we can displace inconveniences with technologic capability, we will see that occur over that window of time that you suggested. So I would like to think that 15 or 20 years from now, the passage through the checkpoint at the airports will be relatively uneventful for all of us. Now, I say that with the because you predicated that question with the idea that nothing had occurred. We had not had another event, if you will, associated with the commercial aviation. And if you do keep that predicate in place, then I worry about the complacency gene, which is in all of us, sort of kicking in and allowing us to lose the focus that I believe we have to maintain. And the people that have to do that maintenance for us, the conscience, if you will, of the traveling public, has to be those professional checkpoint screeners and their senior bosses, if you will, at the airport itself. So I would like to think technologically we will have done a dramatically better job. We will have found new ways of doing business that can displace inconvenience and provide technical capability along the way. I also would like to think that we would have graduated from looking at tactics and looking to find the tools of the terrorist, and graduated towards identifying the terrorist itself. You mentioned iris scanning quickly in your question. The very notion of biometric capability presumes that there is a very thorough watch list, one that goes to your second question about being one that is accepted worldwide. You know, the list of the bad guys with whom we have lots of information, potentially including biometrics, whether that's about fingerprints or whether that's about iris or whether about that facial recognition, whether it's about a package that integrates those things. It's about iris on the move as opposed to iris where you have to stand still and look into a little tiny window. So all of those things represent a potential displacement of inconvenience by technology down the road. With respect to your more general question about law enforcement agencies worldwide, I can tell you that in my time, both at TSA and at DHS, and clearly still being the case, the coordination and cooperation between and among agencies around the world has never been better, has never been higher. There are certain countries with whom we work together to solve problems simply as if they were members of our own agency. And then you have the Interpols of the world, who are by design international organizations that can provide us the venue for the databases attendant to arming that technical capability at the airport of the future. So all of these things are in the mind of those folks who are running TSA, those folks who are running airlines, those folks who are running DHS, with a view towards minimizing inconvenience and maximizing the protection of the passenger.
All right. Hope that gets at the core of the question. We have someone else next up is Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I was just shocked to hear that you think that we're doing a good job with the cabin. I mean, it's a disaster. Maybe you haven't flown in 5 years, but first of all, you're still equating identity with intent. You've got this watch list that is, first of all, hugely inaccurate. Second of all, due to the number of names, even if it were accurate, it would be a complete waste of time. From a statistical standpoint, you simply can't pinpoint people in that way. You will end up with a massive number of false positives to the extent that your screeners fail. The math just doesn't work out. As you mentioned, you're focusing on tactics instead of you want to move that more in the direction of identity, but you don't know the identity of the terrorists for the most part before they do their act. And if you did, they would simply recruit people you don't know. I'm just shocked to hear that you think that moving more towards identity is the right approach. And focusing on tactics is also clearly not the right approach. Because as history has shown over and over again, there are an infinite number of tactics. You need to be working on is strategy. You need to be doing old-fashioned shoe leather work that identifies people who have an intent to do a damaging act. That's what happened in all of the cases where we've had people stop a disaster from happening. And things like the liquid ban are... It's theater. It's security theater. It's there to keep us from thinking that somebody's going to come on with liquid. They didn't get stopped at the airport. They got found out through good old-fashioned detective work.
Well, let's get a response from the guest.
Well, thank you for your question, and thank you for your sarcasm, because in the middle of all of that, there's a workable challenge for all of us as citizens and folks who are responsible for these things going forward. First of all, your notion about being focused on moving toward identity as opposed to continuing to concentrate on tactics, I would offer that there is no silver bullet out there. We looked very hard and long for it, and so far have come up empty, the we being those of us who are working in those trenches in the 4 years that I was at TSA and DHS. But I would offer that the notion of defaulting to a layered system is the right way to go. And the move toward identity is not a displacement of the existing layers, but rather the addition of a capable identity system. That's about training folks in behavior observation. It's about making certain that as we have military play, whether it's in Iraq, Afghanistan, or anywhere else, we are consciously about the business of incorporating into that database additional terrorists when we come to know them. I would grant you the notion that none of these systems are foolproof, and that's what I opened my comments with at the beginning of our conversation here today with David, that as much as we would like to think that America can come up with a 100% guaranteed solution these days, I would offer that the environment that we're all still trying to learn about and understand post 9/11 lends the reality of managing risk and the skills and competencies necessary to manage risk well is, like it or not, the new way of doing business post 9/11. So watch lists are not perfect, but they are on the way to being a dramatically better integrated effort than the past. The notion of identity with intent and being surprised, if you will, by that person who would commit a terrorist act and never having been on anybody's watch list, we understand that. But it does not suggest that as a result of understanding that, you should ignore those who are already identified as terrorists and make a concerted effort to keep them out of the cabin of the aircraft. So again, I would offer that this is we can't find that perfect solution. If there is, we invite the input by way of lots of different ways of offering ideas into the administration of TSA and DHS. And I certainly would encourage listeners who have good ideas to communicate those good ideas with the people that are responsible for these things. And I am absolutely certain that they will be taken quite seriously.
Did you want to do a quick follow-up?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, that's not actually realistic. The if you see something, say something campaign in New York, which sounds pretty similar to what you're talking about. But people having good ideas is not an effect. People don't have a conduit to effectively get those ideas to be taken seriously, as you say. And even if they did, that's not the way decision making happens in any organization. That's bigger than a couple people, but more to the point. I mean, you say that these watch lists are on their way to becoming effective. Great. So dump them until they're effective and they're not a massive civil rights violation. You talked earlier about, you said that you have the people who come in and propose new technologies. You have them give you the economic background and the civil rights implications and the how it will affect commerce and that kind of thing. I just find it. I'm sure that you mean it when you say that, but what I see in practice is just a bunch of things that are implemented badly. I mean, even if we were tracking who enters the airport effectively, we still aren't tracking who gets on the plane. You put your ID away as soon as you go through that checkpoint. That's probably some sort of, you're probably trying to assuage some civil liberties issue. But if you're not allowed to enter the secured area unless your identity is checked, why would you then not have to enter the plane when have your identity checked when you enter the plane? It seems like a really hodgepodge where civil liberties gets a major backseat to all of these other issues, and that would be okay if the techniques were really hard hitting and 100% effective or something like that. But they're not. I mean, they're 95% effective, where your 95% represents 6 million passengers a month, and your 5% error affects 6 million passengers a month.
Well, let's again. I forgive me for interrupting there. I just want to again give the guest a chance to respond, and then I've got another caller I want to get to.
Thanks, David, and thanks for the caller. I sincerely appreciate your concern here, because what I want to assure you is that level of concern is precisely what is moving people to find even better solutions than what we have today. The old notion in the 80s of continuous improvement is sort of where we find ourselves with this set of challenges post 9/11. The notion, first of all, let me correct I don't want to leave the listeners to believe that the conduit for good ideas is non-existent. There truly is several very concrete means by which you can, if you have an observation, a good idea, and I'm not talking about the streets of New York and calling the police officer when you see something out of the ordinary. If you have a thoughtful idea that could improve what you understand and have carefully considered to be the security system of the nation, there are lots of ways through DHS and through TSA that those ideas can be brought to the table. Secondly, this idea about a strategy capability, that's precisely what we're doing. You quoted numbers there for a moment where you inferred, and I don't know what the right number is, that there's a 95% success rate and it's the other 5% that are paying the price. As I open my thoughts here, what I wanted to make certain that the listening audience understands is that this defaulted position in terms of aviation security is inside the envelope of managing risk, which is just, whether we like it or not, a very real ingredient to the post 9/11 security environment. So if you can take advantage of the law of aggregate numbers and line up a dozen or more tactical ideas, each of which may be only at the 70, 80, or 90% success rate, the collective effort is well into the 90s and gets us as close as we can get these days. The reality of that is that it then has to be brought down to a simple red, yellow, green structure at the checkpoint itself. And if, in fact, all of these systems can identify someone as a person that we should not be concerned about, then we wish them to have a nice day and get them on the airplane. If there are those who have had questions as a result of any of those elements of the total system, that's what secondary screening is all about, and we're very careful with secondary screening before we let that person on the airplane. And then the red light speaks for itself in terms of law enforcement intervention, if that's appropriate and to the moment.
We have as our guest in this hour of Focus 580 Admiral James Loy. He served as the Deputy Secretary for the Department of Homeland Security from 2003 until 2005. Before that, he was Administrator of the TSA, Transportation Security Administration, and before that, had a long career in the Coast Guard. He retired in 2002, having served as the Commandant, also as the Chief of Staff and the Commander of the Guard's Atlantic Area. He's visiting the campus here. His visit is sponsored by the College of Law. He'll be talking about some of the same issues, I'm sure, in a talk this afternoon at 3:30, I believe that
3:00.
It is. Pardon me, 3 o'clock. It's right here in front of me. Yes, 3 o'clock this afternoon in the Rowe Auditorium at the law school. So anybody who's interested should stop by. We have another caller here. We have others who would be welcome. We are moving into our last 15 minutes, though. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Champaign County is up next, line one. Hello.
Hi. I confess I've been on and off the show, so if you've treated any of these, I do have a civil liberties question, but one of the two things you highlighted at the beginning was sensitive things like nuclear plants, chemical establishments, and I'm wondering on a very fairly straightforward question what you can say about how that's been handled. But the civil liberties question is regarding what have been variously called fusion and synchronization offices. The idea is that to cut through the hierarchy and Homeland Security having good connections with people on the ground who would have to respond to any kind of disaster or terrorist attack, which is a good idea, but I can count at least two major abuses that went ahead, and one of them is in California, where the head of the National Guard, who was somehow connected to the investigation of peace groups who were trying to do a, among other things, a Mother's Day demonstration against the war in Iraq. They were using a variety of methods, infiltration, the Talon system, which that has been admitted to. The fellow resigned, but the investigation after the fact was not very complete. They didn't really look into the details, including the fact that some of his hard drives were not surrendered to the authorities who were supposedly going to investigate it. And the other one is the synchronization office in Minneapolis, most recently during the RNC, where they coordinated a preemptive a busting of journalists, followed by a widespread, obviously provisions had to be made for disruption, et cetera, but to preemptively bust a journalist group is, and it hasn't gotten the press that one would think it should have gotten, at least in my opinion, which is partly why I'm raising it here. And I don't know what how informed you are on either of those two circumstances, but abuses have happened, and those are just the ones that we know about. And I'm not gainsaying the project entirely, though I thought the Homeland Security, the way it was instituted and the way the Bush administration used it as a way to bust unions was fairly damning and manipulative thing to start with. But I don't want you to particularly comment on that. Again, that's for the wider audience. So I'll listen.
All right. Well, go ahead.
Well, let me take a crack at the first thing that you mentioned, and it was about critical infrastructure protection in general. And you mentioned the nuclear and chemical worlds as elements of that challenge. As you probably well know, the president issued an executive order charging the Department of Homeland Security and all of the other cabinet-level officers to design and produce what we called sector-specific plans to the 17 sectors, now 17 when the order was issued. To take a hold of and grasp and develop the sector-specific plans attendant to each of those sectors. And these are things like transportation, banking and finance, public health, water, food, et cetera, et cetera. The challenge attendant to that is extraordinary. Fact number one, 85% of the critical infrastructure of our country is owned by the private sector, so it's not as if the federal government can just take over and design a sector-specific plan, for example, in the chemical sector, without the cooperation, collaboration, and assistance of the people that own all those facilities. So as it relates to those two, let's take nuclear for just a second. Nuclear, of course, being probably the most regulated industry in our country, with a long history of both safety and security attention having been paid to it from the very beginning. You asked me to give sort of an evaluation as to whether or not I thought those things were in pretty good shape at this point 7 years after 9/11. I think they were in probably pretty good shape on 9/11, and there have been enhancements to the security posture, including you have to think of these things in terms of preventing bad things from happening and protecting the infrastructure sort of up front, but you also have to give balanced attention to the response capability should something occur and the recovery capability. A lot of people are using the word resiliency these days, which is a suggestion that we should be paying an awful lot of attention to our ability should an event occur to recover and become resilient in that particular segment of our economy or a particular segment of our society. The nuclear package, I think, in general, is probably at the top of the list of those things that are in very good shape. The chemical industry has just had a new set of regulations issued by the Department of Homeland Security. Those are about 6 months old now, and there is a tremendously positive public-private partnership attendant to the means by which those standards were being established and set, and the means by which the owners of that critical infrastructure in the private sector would would come to meet those standards over time. So that's one of those 17 sectors like nuclear that is well down the road. You ask about the civil liberties implications of fusion centers and synchronization offices. I must admit, I've been out of government now for a little over 3 years, so the phrase synchronization offices is not one that I'm familiar with. But clearly, the fusion opportunities were rampant and needed to be dealt with constructively, and I think have been dealt with constructively over time. We had multiple agencies designing multiple lists of multiple things, and in order for the collaborative effort that has to be mounted, both in prevention and protection protocols as well as response and recovery protocols, demands a dramatically better coordinated effort. And that has now been on the way to being accomplished by way of, among other things, these fusion centers that allow the same information to be available that anyone has to everyone else. I'm not at all familiar with the National Guard incident in California. You know, I just take your point that there will always be the potential for humans to enter the system of whatever the the protocols and game plans on the table are supposed to be, if the Minneapolis effort was as you described it to be, and I'm not familiar enough with that to be able to validate facts one way or the other for you, let alone the investigative aftermath. Again, not being a student of Minneapolis government or familiar with the case in terms of what actually occurred or how they're dealing with it or how they're investigating it in the aftermath. But clearly there will always be, regardless of how well you think you have put together something sensitive to civil liberties and something sensitive to economic implications in the face of a need for a greater security paradigm, there will always be those who overuse, underuse, violate, fail to violate, those kind of standards. That's just, I don't want to sort of generalize and suggest that we can just expect those things as a human nature kind of reality. But when they occur, they should in fact be dealt with as constructively as possible by authorities that are responsible. And I don't know why there has not been more of a media outcry if, in fact, this was a journalist-based event in Minneapolis. It's an interesting point that you make.
Just about 7-8 minutes left. Hope the caller will forgive me if I want to try to get into one or two other areas in the time that we have left. And also just again for people who have tuned in very quickly to say that our guest this morning is Admiral James Loy. He's former Deputy Secretary for the Department of Homeland Security. One area that I'd like to at least try to talk about for a couple of minutes is port security. Mm-hmm. Again, another one of these areas in the wake of 9/11 that people pointed to and said, here we have a serious issue mm-hmm. because we have very large numbers of containers coming in by ship to the United States mm-hmm. and only a very small percentage of them are inspected. And if one wanted to introduce a weapon of mass destruction to the country, well, that would be a pretty good way to do it. What are we doing in terms of inspecting shipping containers now?
Well, it's been on the front burner of concern from day one, as you might imagine, David. As I sat in my office in Coast Guard headquarters on 9/11, once the second plane hit the second tower in New York, and it was quite clearly an aggressive terrorist attack, as opposed to what we sort of were hoping for as an accident, if you will, in the first instance of the first building. My mind and my responsibilities immediately shifted to the ports of our country because we had no idea, where the second shoe might drop, so to speak, over the course of not only that day but days and weeks and months that followed. And so my responsibilities were to reorient the focus of Coast Guard activity generally towards the ports of our country. One of the great strengths of the U.S. Coast Guard is its adaptability. It's a multi-mission organization by character. It has a foot in the military camp, a foot in the law enforcement camp, a foot in humanitarian camps, a foot in ecological camps. It does a lot of good things for America over time. And the idea of being able to reorient the focus of that organization's activities towards securing our ports going down the road was an immediate challenge, which we met head on. One of the things I did that first day interestingly enough, was take a call from a dear friend who was the Secretary General of the International Maritime Organization, a standard-setting body inside the UN envelope that sets standards for the maritime environment. They historically had been about the business of safety and protecting the environment, and part of our conversation that day went to recognizing that whether they liked it or not, they had a new major work stream to deal with, and that was the security of the maritime environment. So following that conversation, 2 months later, on the 15th of November, 01, I led a U.S. delegation to IMO where we began the process of establishing international standards for shipping that was attendant to the realities of a security challenge in the 21st century. As it relates to containers themselves, we find ourselves again in this this trade-off between the flow of commerce on one hand and the imperatives for security in some instances on the other. So when you think about WMD, when you think about nuclear things, chemical things, biological things, even cyber things these days, explosive things, all of a sudden this notion of holding on to 100% certainty where we can in instances like that continues to be the goals of those who are designing the means by which we will cope with hundreds of thousands of containers that cross our borders every year. So I can assure the American public as we speak that the detection capability for the nuclear side of that is in place and doing a good job. Mm-hmm. In the same manner that we're looking at 2 million passengers a day getting on airports, there's X number of containers a day coming through our ports. What is the means by which we recognize that 100% guarantees of opening and inspecting all those containers would bring our economy to a standstill is an unacceptable approach. So what is the process where you assemble data and information and allow the hundreds of thousands of containers to be placed in green lane, yellow lane, red lane kind of in the same manner that we deal with passengers getting on aircraft, and let that information flow identify those containers that, if suspect, would lend themselves to a closer scrutiny as they cross our borders. You mentioned that containers coming into our ports is just one of those means by which one would imagine. But think about our society in general. Think about our borders with Mexico and Canada, the maritime borders, of course, through the ports of the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean. Our vulnerability as a nation, so to speak, which we were proud of as a welcoming nation right up till 9/11/01, has been reoriented to challenge us to remain a welcoming nation on one hand, but to be very, very careful and scrutinize those things which cross our borders, whether they're in containers or whether they're on foot.
Yeah. We're down to the point here. We have just a couple of minutes. As a final point, the goal of those things that we have talked about and all those things that we haven't is deterrence. Mm. And I'm sure that there are people who have worked in this area who would say that deterrence is not the same thing as prevention. Do you think the government be telling the American people it's going to happen? We do not think that because it hasn't happened since 9/11 that it's never going to happen again. And is there some way to deliver that message in a way that's
doesn't induce fear?
Well, yeah. But also gets the reality of it across to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a wonderful question, David. And deterrence, of course, is a part of prevention and protection. So I guess I would think of it this way: there is a responsibility ethic that has to be reborn in our nation. I think in the days that followed 9/11, there was a patriotic zeal leaning forward where citizens and companies were anxious to provide their contribution to whatever would be necessary to secure our country. Here we are 7 years later, and in some fashions, I never totally agreed with the idea of you citizens just you know, keep shopping, keep going to the mall, we'll take care of you, quote unquote. That general notion I found to be an inappropriate challenge to the American people. I mean, we as citizens, first and foremost, in order to enjoy our citizenship in this great country, have to meet our obligations as citizens wherever it's appropriate to do so. And in that obligation sense, there's a preparedness goal for us as a nation across the board that begins with each of us as citizens to protect our families, to protect our neighborhoods, to protect if we're a small business owner, our employees, and goes right up the line to those responsible for policy at the federal level as a package deal, if you will, at the other end of the day, where engaged citizens are our first responders, if you will, at the other end of the day. So deterrence is a goal set inside the general notion of prevention and protection, and the responsibility for all of that, I believe, must begin with each of us as citizens and play through the policies that can be generated by those in responsible positions in government.
Well, I think at that, with much more to be said, we're going to have to stop because we've here come to the end of the time. Our guest, Admiral James Loy, he served as the Deputy Secretary for the Department of Homeland Security 2003-2005. He was also administrator with the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, and was Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard and had a long career in the Coast Guard before he retired in 2002. He is visiting the campus, his visit sponsored by the College of Law, and he'll be giving a talk, I'm sure, dealing with many of these same issues this afternoon at 3 o'clock in the Rowe Auditorium at the Law School. And I expect anyone who would be interested in attending should feel welcome. Admiral Loy, thank you very much.
David, thank you for the opportunity.